The Ryan Tuberty Show on RTE Radio 1. Sponsored by Sky Broadband. Get the power to do more with Sky's best ever Wi-Fi.
Now, my guest this morning is trained as both a psychiatrist and a forensic psychotherapist. She spent nearly two decades in Broadmoor, one of Britain's most notorious high-security psychiatric facilities. Her book, The Devil You Know, Stories of Human Cruelty and Compassion, gives us a rare insight into how people who commit the most horrendous crimes deal with them, not that they always do, and why this is important. Dr. Gwen Adshead, good morning to you.
Good morning, good morning.
First of all, what sort of crimes have the people that you treat committed?
Oh, well, they have always committed very serious violent offences. You don't get admitted to a high-security psychiatric hospital anywhere in England and Scotland and Northern Ireland unless you've committed crimes of very serious violence. And the key issue is that it's thought that your mental health problems may have played a part in the violence that you committed. So the people that we look after are people in general who've committed acts like murder, manslaughter, serious violence.
And it's men and women. Women, what do they commit similar crimes to the men?
Well, we don't have any women in Broadmoor Hospital or in any of the high secure hospitals in England and Wales. But when women do commit acts of violence, they commit them far more rarely than men.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of the interesting questions that we really don't fully understand, which is why women commit so much less violence than men. But when they do commit acts of violence, they can be quite similar. So women can be convicted of murder and manslaughter in the same way as men can be.
So your job is basically to help, if we can put it that way, sex offenders. You're talking about murderers, people who've committed the unspeakable crimes. What kind of a reaction do you get from people when you tell them what you do for a living?
Well, sometimes people are a bit shocked, and I think sometimes people are a bit offended almost. I think sometimes people think, well, you shouldn't be providing help to people like that, and some people say, well, that's, you know, you're trying to minimize what they've done. And that's really not what we do. What we're really trying to do is provide therapy to disturb people, to improve their mental health, which we also hope will reduce their risk. So this book is really a kind of invitation to come inside and see what happens to people after they've been convicted of terrible violence and to see how we try and help them change their minds for the better and maybe, hopefully, become less risky as a result.
Because you say in the book as well that, you know, you're confronting serial killers often in your line of work, but you describe it, your experience more as sad rather than scary.
I would say so, yes. That's been my experience, that you know, if you're working in a prison or a secure psychiatric hospital, we take lots of steps to keep ourselves safe, and we know where the danger is. So actually, I very rarely felt frightened in my work, but often I feel sad because of the terrible things that people have done, but also the terrible things that have happened to them as well. But I also sometimes can feel hopeful and sometimes really privileged to work with a team of people to try and help people change for the better.
Now, we know lots of people suffer severe mental health problems and they never commit a crime, most of them, in fact. So what causes the people you've treated to become violent and to overstep that mark?
That's a really, really good and interesting question. And in the book, what Eileen and I set out is a kind of theory about that called the sort of bicycle lock theory, which is that in order for an act of violence to take place, you probably need a lot of risk factors in place all at the same time. And things like substance misuse is one thing. Having previously committed violence is another risk factor. And occasionally, paranoid states of mind can be a risk factor. So while it's absolutely the case that very few people with mental health problems will ever be violent, if they do get into paranoid mental states and they do misuse alcohol or illicit drugs, and then if some kind of traumatic event happens to them, often kinds of extensive childhood trauma, that can sometimes increase people's risk of acting violently.
So overall, and it feels like a big ask given some of the crimes that they may have committed, are you hoping to influence people to think more sympathetically to those who end up in places like Broadmoor?
Yes, I think that's a good way of putting it. I think, you know, when I started, I had the same, you know, fear and anxieties and was perhaps wondering a little bit about whether this was good work to do. But though, as I've gone on in my work, I've realized that it's possible to have a kind of radical empathy for people, to feel a kind of compassion for people who've done terrible things while also maintaining a little distance. But I really passionately believe that actually, if we invest in helping these people, it's in all our interests that we do that. And we can all benefit from making sure that people who've done horrible things get the support and therapy they need.
And that's kind of important in the context of you talking about the size and the growth of prison populations and the correlation between mental health budgets going down. But the prison populations are increasing despite crime falling. Can you explain a little bit about that to us?
Well, it's difficult, I think. I think that one reason is that for reasons that we don't fully understand, both here and in the States, in the last 30 years, there seems to have been more of a public appetite for revenge. Mm-hmm. It sort of feels like people want longer and longer sentences, and politicians respond to that feeling. And the difficulty about that is that it's actually quite expensive to keep people in prisons for very long periods. It costs quite a lot of money. It can cost anywhere between £20,000 and £40,000 a year to keep someone in prison. So if you're spending that amount of money, I think we have to ask ourselves whether that money might not be better spent on violence prevention, but also perhaps looking at different ways of constricting people's liberty or condemning them, if that's what we want to do. I wonder if really incarcerating people long term is a bit too expensive for us all. We probably need to do better than that. I think, again, it's probably in all our interest to think in a bit of a broader way about how we want to show our disapproval of people who've broken the criminal law.
Well, the disapproval is the thing. It's almost hard to get around, though, isn't it? You know, when a really terrible crime has been committed, and sometimes the emotion goes right across a nation, a society, a population, and we do have that thirst for revenge. What does it say about us? We kind of would say, we don't care how much it costs, lock that person up for as long as we possibly can.
And I understand. I think any of us who work in prisons and the criminal justice system, we understand that revenge is a very powerful kind of emotion. There was a writer called Francis Bacon who called revenge a kind of wild justice. And I think that there's something here about understanding people's passion for justice, but also trying to help people to manage their distress when something terrible has happened. In a slightly different way, while respecting justice without it going wild and getting a bit out of control. But I think we do have to pay, tremendous respect to the victims of violence. And in the book, I say how very important it is when I'm working with people who committed acts of violence to remember the people that they hurt and the families of those they hurt. Mm-hmm. And that's a really important part of the work that I do.
The book itself, The Devil You Know, it consists of 9 mosaic case histories of 11 patients you were working with. So, I mean, can you explain how you put those together? Because they are, self-contained stories, but they feel quite dramatic because of the collaboration that you did. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, it was very important to me to work with a professional storyteller and dramatist because, of course, from an ethical and legal point of view, I couldn't actually use people's actual stories in a book. That would be wrong on many levels. So what I needed to do was take tiny fragments of people's stories that were completely unidentifiable and, with Eileen's help, weave them into a narrative. So all the details are clinically real. The things that I've described there have all happened. I actually have heard about them or read about them. Dealt with them myself personally,
yeah.
But every person is a composite of people like that I've seen. So, for example, the very first case is a story of someone who would be labelled as a serial killer because he's killed at least 3 people, and I've seen several men like that, but I've weaved them into a kind of composite. So to try and get the flavor across of the kind of person and the kind of story that I've been listening to any time these last 30 years.
It was actually interesting you mentioned the first one, because one of the things you say in the introduction is that you won't find these on a Google search result, but that somehow didn't stop me trying to Google the story because you have, as you say, there were at least three killings, and one of them was pretty gruesome. It involved a decapitation. Yes. I mean, how many cases are kind of weaved into any particular chapter?
Oh, it can be anything from sort of, I mean, the smallest number, I think, would probably be about 5. But the biggest ones might be as many as 200.
There are times where I almost felt guilty for being slightly entertained by what I knew were real and very serious cases that had led to terrible consequences for victims and their families. And you've pretty certain stuff to say about true crime and its industry, the entertainment industry around it.
Well, I understand. Again, it's interesting, isn't it? I think it must be linked up perhaps with our interest in crime and justice. I mean, one of the things that made me want to write this book is is that I know how many people are interested in this kind of world.
Yeah.
I mean, everyone I know has a view about goodness and badness and what should happen to people who've done terrible things. So that's part of the reason that I wanted to write this book. But I was also very clear that I didn't want to write something that was going to be exploitative or salacious in some way. I knew that the material would have to be disturbing because the material is disturbing. But I really didn't want it to be the kind of book that sort of dwelt on the victim's suffering. What I wanted to try and convey is the work and effort that goes into trying to change somebody's mind for the better and how important that work is.
There's a fascinating line you have in there, and it's almost chilling in a way, because you talk about the actual, who you believe are the actual criminal psychopaths, don't actually end up committing crimes themselves because it would be detrimental to their welfare.
Yes, I think that's right. Even in the States, where they've done probably more research on psychopaths than anywhere else, even in prisons where they house lots of violent offenders, only about a third of them, between a quarter and a third of them, would actually meet criteria for psychopathy. So being a psychopath is actually pretty rare, even among violent offenders. And it's very likely that if you really are a cold, calculating, remorseless kind of a person, if you're smart enough, you're never going to carry out the violence yourself. Mm-hmm. You're going to get other people to do that for you. And so we see, in my experience, I have met people who would meet criteria for that kind of label of psychopathy, but it's quite unusual in my experience.
Okay, when we get down to then you treating the patients who have committed terrible crimes, as you say, it's more sad than scary. Childhood seems to be a big factor when you dig right down into their minds.
Yes, I think that's right. And because, you know, we all have to grow a mind, and we grow our minds during childhood and adolescence. And that's why we very properly take childhood and adolescence and young people's mental health very seriously, because it's often only in early childhood and adolescence that the first problems really start to emerge, with problems with mood regulation, anger regulation, feeling suicidal, thinking about hurting yourself, thinking about hurting other people. These often first emerge in the teenage years. And it's why we really want to take child and adolescent mental health really seriously. And we've had a big problem here in England that our services for child and adolescent mental health have been seriously cut back. And a lot of the family therapy that we used to offer just doesn't happen anymore. So I'm really making really try to emphasize in this book that we need to take children's growing experiences really seriously, because, you know, often a good intervention early on might prevent a world of pain later.
Yeah. When you're talking about the crimes and the talking about the specific crime itself as part of that therapy process, what is it like when you're hearing your clients, your patients, talking specifically about what they've done?
Well, I guess, you know, in a way, what I'm doing then is exactly what all, I hope, you know, good doctors do, which is to try and stay focused on the patient and their experience, and try and put my own feelings on hold while I listen to what they have to say, because I'm there to try and support them and the work I'm doing with them. So I'm obviously listening very carefully to what they're saying, but there's a part of me, like any good doctor, that tries to stay a little detached to try mm-hmm. and keep a sort of keep my mind and ears and eyes open to what's going on for this person.
Because the odd time you've come across a patient who you initially started thinking about in a negative way.
Occasionally, oh yes, no, very much so. I mean, I've had experiences when I came in and I know that I was perhaps a bit put off by the patients. The patient might have presented in a sort of angry or standoffish way. There's one man that we describe in the book who started off in presenting in a very arrogant kind of way. Mm-hmm. And it took a while for me to understand that underneath the arrogance was somebody who felt very vulnerable and frightened. And that actually by making it possible, by staying with him, despite feeling annoyed by him at times, by staying with the work, we could help him get to the vulnerability underneath and express sorrow and remorse for what he'd done. And then he was able to go back to prison and work on his offence.
Can you treat somebody who, perhaps a violent offender, who has denied what they're doing and are insisting on their innocence? Is there any way of treating that type of...
That's a really, really interesting question. And funnily enough, there is a bit of evidence now that you can, that actually denial is not always a bar to making progress and reducing risk. Mm. And I have some very, very expert colleagues in this field who, particularly working with sex offenders, who found that you don't always have to get people to admit what they've done in order to help them try and prepare for risk reduction. Again, because sometimes this is about shame, and if you just bash away at people's shame, all that happens is they get defensive and they don't really want to work with you. Whereas if you can say, well, look, you know, we're going to have to disagree about this, but what are we going to do about how you're going to keep yourself safe in future? And actually, it looks as though there's a bit of evidence that you can actually make a working alliance with people, even if they're in denial.
And I suppose dealing with this subject matter must have a fair weight on your own mind.
Well, it's true that that's something that I have to think about. I would be foolish as a mental health professional not to take my own mental health seriously. And so I guess what I try and do is make sure that I try and leave my working feelings at work as far as I can. And I also, in my own personal time, I try and invest in the good things about the world and other people and remind myself that, you know, that is just as real as anything bad that happens in the world, that human goodness is as real as that, and that there's lots of really real richness and goodness to enjoy.
You did suffer, though, for your work at some point, didn't you? I think you describe feeling depressed or almost being diagnosed, I think, with depression at one stage towards the...
Yes, well, like many women, I developed a quite significant postnatal depression, and that caused me to struggle at work a bit. It is true that it's hard to work in prisons and secure places if you're feeling either grief or a kind of numbness. I know. So, but I also found actually that my work was sometimes very helpful, and the support of colleagues and doing good work was actually quite helpful in my recovery. So recovery from mental health is complicated because for some people, they won't feel able to work. But for other people, work is a very important part of recovery, and it certainly was for me. And as well as antidepressants and having some therapy as well. So I'm very, you know, I do have a service user experience of being a patient, and I know how complicated recovery can be, but I also know that it's real. I know that it's possible to recover from depression and anxiety.
Tell us about the story of Lydia. I know it's about stalking, and it's, as you say, the female offenders are very rare, but the crimes are different, aren't they? There's a different theme sometimes.
Well, Lydia is indeed a case of a female stalker, and she's based on a number of cases of female stalking that I've been involved with over the years. And what struck me about them is just how intransigent they can be, mm-hmm. and how they can rarely result in quite significant violence and harassment. to the victims, and the victims could be anybody. Unlike male stalkers, where the majority of victims are ex-partners, partners and ex-partners, for women, women stalkers, it's a bit different, and they're quite often professionals that they've come in contact with. So Lydia was a case where it seemed that she had made progress. It seemed that she had changed her mind for the better, but actually she was still very preoccupied with her victim and still wanted to harm him. And I think that really the reason that we included her is partly because it's an invitation to go a bit deep, go beyond the surface. Sometimes when you meet people, they can seem quite normal, but actually if you go a bit deeper and spend a bit more time with them, all sorts of pathology and all sorts of disturbance can emerge. So hers was a case where I sort of, you know, didn't read it right from the beginning, and I thought it was important to describe a case where professionals sometimes get things wrong.
Well, it's kind of fascinating because she obviously went to a therapist. She ends up stalking her therapist. So someone who went for help, but actually going to help, it ends up being the crime that she commits.
Yes, absolutely. And of course, what that tells us is that stalking always does involve, I think, strong emotions of some sort. It always, the stalker does have strong emotions for the person that they're stalking. It's just that those emotions are unreasonable. And what's interesting about it, too, I think, is all stalkers really have no interest in the mind of what's happening to the person that they're stalking. In a way, the person that they're stalking is not a real person to them. They're a kind of figure of their own internal fantasy and their own internal narrative. And that's why it's so irrational. That's why the poor victims of stalkers feel so helpless and nonplussed, because it doesn't make any sense. But that's the point. It's a kind of mad obsession. It's not common, but it is problematic for victims. Mm.
I just want to very quickly put two questions from our listeners to you. What about children who commit violent crimes? Asked Liz in Leitrim.
Oh, what an excellent question. Well, again, very rare, thankfully, but it is very rare to meet children who commit acts of violence who haven't been exposed to significant abuse and neglect as children. Very, very rare indeed.
Is it not more about fear than revenge when society wants violent criminals put away for long periods?
Well, and that's a really good point, which I was going to mention earlier on, which is that there probably are some people who may be so disturbed in their minds that it's probably safest to keep them detained for a long period of time. I think there probably are such men and such women who need long-term detention. But I think their numbers are very few, and we probably don't need quite as much long-term detention as we think we do.
That's your overall point, isn't it? There's far too
yes.
many. Look, it's a fascinating story. I was also interested in the fact that I know that you don't like the true crime entertainment and the representation which feeds into that whole monstrous and evil and so on, which does nobody any favours. But do you like detective novels, the stories yourself?
I do. I like the intellectual puzzle.
Okay.
Of it, I think. I think because, like detectives and detective stories, we know who done it, but we want to know why done it.
Yes. Okay. So it's the problem solving is what you like, as opposed to the.
It's the problem solving that I like.
Dr. Gwen Adshead, thank you very much for joining us. The Devil You Know is the name of the book, Stories of Human Cruelty and Compassion. And it's written by Gwen, and Eileen Horn was the TV producer. And best wishes.
Thank you so much for having me.